Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sport pods. If you didn't drink, you were in the minority.
Zola and Bergkamp were absolute geniuses.
Step by step, more and more players came to England.
Hi there, welcome to Premier League Storybook with me, Jake Humphrey. This is Chapter 5, The Culture Clash. English football have been doing things the same way for decades. The old school mentality of drinking clubs on days off, fast food breakfasts and hungover cross-country runs. In the mid-90s, however, the game's top stars from abroad were attracted to the new Premier League riches and started changing the way the players looked at their careers on and off the pitch. I can't wait for you to hear my chat with Jürgen Klinsmann, the World Cup winner who arrived at Tottenham in 1994, but we've spoken to loads of top names around the game at the time to get a feel for this clash of cultures. We'll hear how Ruud Gullit had to be kept away from Chelsea's training ground before signing and how Arsene Wenger tried to stop Nigel Winterburn's birthday. But first, Steve McManaman grew up in a Liverpool team who'd won it all in the 80s and were faced with continental ideas at the start of the decade.
Our initial clash was with Graeme Souness. When I say our initial clash, it wasn't necessarily a clash with me, but Graeme Souness came in 1992, didn't he? And started to bring his own ideas in that he'd incorporated that in Italy, which were all the right ideas. He was just probably ahead of his time, funny enough. Arsene Wenger got all the credit in the end, but actually it was Graeme Souness. And he was met with a clash of the older players at Liverpool who were incredibly successful and them not wanting to change because they thought that what they'd done for the previous 10 years and they'd been so successful with meant that they could carry on. And I think that's where you see it, and that's where I saw it initially. So you've got the likes of Ian Rush and Steve McMahon and Ronnie Whelan saying, well, we've done this for the last 10 years. And Graeme Souness saying to them, well, this is better for you now. And they're like, well, we've done this forever and we've been incredibly successful, so we want to carry on doing it. And that was the clash. When a lot of foreign players came in, the ideas, I think, were already set at Liverpool when I arrived. They brought their own ideas in and their ideas of what we should do and what you shouldn't do. And I found it even more striking when I went to Real Madrid, going the other way about these different ideas. You know, my initial clash of cultures was with Graeme Souness because he'd played abroad and he decided that this was the right thing to do. And it wasn't met as openly as it probably should have been. And it would have been openly met 4 or 5 years later. But it was too early on at Liverpool to change the dynamic.
We all know the Chelsea of today as a European conquering cosmopolitan juggernaut. That certainly wasn't the case, though, before the arrival of Glenn Hoddle in 1993, who was shocked to see the facilities at the club's Harlington training ground.
Well, when I went in 93, it was very disappointing, I've got to say. I was shocked at the facilities at the time. Nothing like it is today at Chelsea, but I'd left Swindon thinking I was going up the ladder, which I was club-wise, but certainly facilities and to a certain degree as well the squad, technically, Swindon were better, the facilities, the way we played. So I knew very quickly that I had a job on my hands, a big job. The pressure of going to Chelsea was big enough, but they hadn't done that much. You know, they hadn't had much success, I suppose, over the many, many years, actually. So it was a real challenge for me, a massive challenge. But then once I got in there quickly, the training ground, everything really, the attitude of the players in many ways, the training facilities, I didn't have an office, there wasn't a bath, even one bath in the training ground, no restaurant, as I say, no office. My office was a BT box on the wall. And I put 50p in it, and it come through, and I was putting 50p again, and I remember having a conversation with Ron Atkinson, and he's going, Glenn, what's that pipping noise in the background? And I didn't have the heart to tell him. I was embarrassed to tell him. So that was Chelsea Football Club at that time.
Chelsea needed to go to the next level. Hoddle helped the club pull off the incredible feat of signing Ruud Gullit, the former World Player of the Year, who'd captured football's imagination in the colours of AC Milan and Holland.
You know, to bring Rudy in, it was a case of keeping him away from the training ground and keeping him away from the old bridge. And the only way I could do it, quite frankly, is I said, look, if we go down to the training ground, there's a lot of building going on. You're going to have to wear a hard hat. And Matthew Harding's stand was being built at the ground. And I said, you're going to have to put a hard hat if we go there. And you don't want your first photo as a Chelsea player. And he hadn't signed. So I said, let's go down to King's Road and we'll have a nice lunch and have a chat about, you know, the future. So fortunately, he went for that one and we got him to sign. And yeah, he wasn't overly impressed with the training ground, I've got to say.
So transfixed were Chelsea with their incredible signing, they made him manager when Hoddle left for the England job in 1996. One of his first signings was Italian midfielder Roberto Di Matteo.
Yeah, I think Italian football in the 90s was probably ahead of the Premier League in terms of physical preparation, tactical preparation and technical preparation. So certainly when we arrived in the 90s, I think we saw that there was maybe a little bit of a gap between the Serie A and the Premier League, but very quickly the Premier League caught up with it. And when I was managing in the Premier League, they were definitely at the same standard, if not higher, than the Serie A.
The biggest influence of all, however, was just a few months away. Arsene Wenger became Arsenal manager in October 1996 to cries of "Arsene who?" from the tabloids. Glenn Hoddle, though, knew different.
I worked with Arsene for 3 years. We won the league, we're in Europe, and I saw his philosophy, how he worked. No one knew Arsene Wenger at Arsenal or anywhere else in English football, really. So it was David Dean that actually made the decision on the board to bring him in. And I said, he'll be successful wherever he goes. If he ends up in Italy, Spain, wherever, England, he'll be successful. And he went and got him. He went and got him, and the rest is history. But no, Arsene was excellent to work with.
Martin Keown was part of the famous Arsenal backline under George Graham, and while he didn't get involved in too many shenanigans, Arsenal were the epitome of the 90s drinking culture. Keown tells us what it was like behind the scenes.
Because I came to London, my father was very switched on, and he told me not to, pee my money up against the wall, not to play cards, not to discuss religion or politics. And I suppose in a way that kind of made me a little bit different from the rest, because it'd be very easy to join in and be one of the lads and have a drink. If you didn't drink, you were in the minority. And by the time I finished my career at Arsenal, it was the reverse of that. That's how professional it became. And to be honest, all the players that remained and went through that journey adhered to that because they needed to, because if you wanted to extend your career, if you wanted to be successful, then basically, as Wenger would say, it's you're poisoning your blood by drinking alcohol, so don't do it. Anything you can do to be successful, it was all part of that. So we were living, breathing and eating in the right way by the time Arsene Wenger really got his feet under the table.
One of Keown's best memories was trying to go on a night out for Nigel Winterburn's birthday.
You know, I remember when we first came, we went to a health club, Henlow Grange. We'd never been before. This was the boss, though. We didn't have a game that weekend. We were playing the following weekend, and he felt it'd be good for the guys to be together, just to train hard, but to also, you know, use the facilities that were there. And I think it was Nigel Winterburn's birthday, and just as he'd come in, it was very early, him and Pat Rice were spending hours looking at tapes, and I went into a room to ask him, could we go out that evening? It was Nigel's birthday. And the boss tore my head off, saying, what is this? You cannot go out. I said, well, look, the boys want to just have a few drinks. Alcohol? Yes, boss, that's what they're looking to do. They sent me in just to... He said, no, I don't. I said, well, look, I'm not asking you, actually. I'm telling you that we're going out. Because if you try and stop that lot from going now, you're going to have a problem. So, yes, okay, but I blame you if they're late. And of course, I couldn't get him out of the pub. I tried hard. I got back to the hotel. I think he said he wanted us back at 10:30, you know, which was quite early. And Pat Rice was in, you know, raised eyebrows, waiting, counting them all in and blaming me when they were late. So it was difficult, but you couldn't stop. And of course, I think the boss had a zero tolerance for alcohol, but fully expected some of them to be having the occasional drink. But that was the stance he was taking, and that message was being spread right through the group.
When did this start then? Ozzie Ardiles was the overseas pioneer of the English game when he came to Tottenham in the late 70s. When he later became manager at White Hart Lane, he picked a World Cup winner and Monaco's star striker Jürgen Klinsmann to follow in his footsteps. Klinsmann was one of the first truly monumental foreign signings that captured the nation's hearts. Let's hear how it happened. So, Jürgen, let's rewind the clock then exactly 30 years. It's 1992. You would have just gone to Monaco from Inter Milan, and the Premier League is just starting. Obviously, here in England, we're all awash with the buzz and the excitement. Were players outside of England aware of this new football league that we'd created?
I would say so, yes, you know, because obviously at that time, late 80s, early 90s, the focus was mainly on the Serie A in Italy. So the best players of the world, they were playing there. I'm thinking about Careca, Maradona, Mateos, Van Basten, Rijkaard, Gullit. All those players were in the Serie A. And then it was noticed that there's a kind of a new approach then in England. I think, you know, over the decades, even in my time, when I was a child growing up, the one league that you watched the most from another country, obviously I was brought up in Germany, was the English league. It was English football. It was Man United, it was Liverpool, those big names in the 70s, 80s. And so when things started to shift a little bit towards England, it was noticed. Now, I mean, I personally went on from Inter Milan to AS Monaco to Arsene Wenger, who was my coach then for 2 years, a fantastic time I had there. But it was noticed that something is happening in England, definitely.
Interesting. And what was your view of English football then up until this point?
Up to this point, the view was always an exciting view, you know, attacking-minded football, great relationship with the fans, no fences, you know, on the sidelines. So when we saw those images always in Germany when I was growing up, you know, I was a big admirer of Kevin Keegan. He was a bit of my hero. besides Gerd Müller, obviously. But the overall view was always on attractive football, attacking football, high energy in the stadiums. That's what mainly came across to the other countries.
Mm. And of course, you know, there was also a big rivalry here, wasn't there, as there is today, between German and English football. You know, that World Cup semi-final of 1990 yeah. springs to mind for you.
Yeah, and I think that all started, obviously, with the 1966 World Cup final at Wembley, when Germany was beaten by this questionable goal. Still today.
What? No. That goal wasn't questionable.
No. But I think, you know, I often said that when I was at Spurs in my days, that English and German football are very similar. It's two nations that love to attack, two nations that love to play attractive football. It's very passionate. The relationship with the fans is very direct, it's very straightforward. And I think even if maybe on both sides, certain people don't want to hear it, but I think we are very similar.
I think you're probably right. So was the Premier League part of the reason then for you coming over to England? Or had you always had the desire at some point in your career that you would come and play in England?
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, it was probably not the bigger picture of the Premier League itself that attracted me the most. It was really the personal side of things, you know. I mean, Alan Sugar came and we had that talk in Monaco. I came just from the World Cup 94 in the United States. I scored 5 goals at the World Cup. Unfortunately, we lost in the quarterfinals. And then Alan Sugar came and we had this talk, and the manager of Spurs was Ozzie Ardiles. Ozzie Ardiles for me was like, what? Ozzie Ardiles? We're talking here about one of the most amazing midfielders at his time, also World Cup winner. And And I got all excited about the people, really about the people. You know, the way Alan Sugar approached it, he came to Monte Carlo. We had a cappuccino, and then within an hour, we were done. We said, we'll do that. You know, we called, I called Arsene Wenger. He was in his office at the club at AS Monaco, and we cut the deal in less than an hour. So it was more this kind of this personal perspective, working with OCR dealers, going to a club with a lot of talent, a lot of young talent, you know, Nick Bambi, Darren Anderton, obviously Teddy Sheringham was there. Exciting kind of view of attacking-minded football. And that's what I was really looking forward to. I mean, mostly in Monaco, often I ended up as a lone striker at Inter Milan. My third season at Inter Milan, I was all by myself up front. And then I got in danger that we had, there was the old Catenaccio system still a bit in place in Italy. You know, as soon as you score a goal, you shut down. and then you say bye-bye to the balls. I was attracted by the people at Tottenham.
Yeah. But were you concerned about, you know, because I remember seeing that you were coming and I was thinking, wow, you know, as you say, you just scored 5 goals at a World Cup. You're a World Cup winner. And you were coming to a team that had finished 15th in the league the season before that. Like, did at no point you look at the league table and think maybe that's not the move for me? That didn't concern you?
To be honest, it didn't concern me. I met Alan Sugar, and you know, I saw him fighting for his position. He said, we are not done yet. We go back into court. We're going to fight the ban from the FA Cup. We're going to find the 12 points deduction. He got it down to 6 points. And it was more for me, the perspective to come to London, to go to a fantastic city, full of Premier League teams, and be part of English football, be part of that excitement. And obviously I was not then the youngest anymore. I mean, I said, you know, you're not getting many opportunities anymore to move to different places and experience a different type of football and meet different type of people. I was of certain things I was not aware. The club was so popular outside of London. You know, I thought, okay, you will have a great following, home games And when I came over, we played the first friendly game in Ireland, I think, against a third division team. I got out there in that small stadium, a stadium for 10,000 people, and I think it was 9,000 Spurs fans. And I was looking around. I said, "This is not real, right?" You know. And I think I asked Teddy Sheringham, "Is this normal?" And he says, "Welcome to Tottenham." He said to me, "You know, it's a special club. It has a huge following." And even when I left, then Spurs. Later on, then when I retired, everywhere in the world you bump into Tottenham people, Tottenham fans, and it's so that I was really extremely positively surprised.
It's interesting when you talk about, you know, you didn't know much about, you know, exactly what you were getting into, because I remember at the time when it was announced, there was a fair bit of ill feeling. I wonder whether you were aware of that. You know, the newspapers and the non-Tottenham fans were saying, oh, Jürgen Klinsmann, he's a diver. You know, the the rivalry of German and English football was being spoken about a lot. Were you aware of any of that kind of negativity when you'd made the decision or not?
No, I was not aware. It was kind of caught me by surprise too, but I was very lucky. I had a friend in southern France, outside of Monte Carlo, and he lived in London before, and he says, well, this is the English way of testing you out. You know, they want to see how you react to a little bit of getting provoked, and it's part of their humor, and you just need to kind of top it up. You need to add something to it, and that's how then the idea kind of came up, to ask for a diving school at my initial press conference when I was presented to the fans and the media. And then obviously it was all Teddy Sheringham's fault, because he came up with the idea at the first game at Sheffield Wednesday, that he said right before the game, you know what, Jürgen, if you score today, we're going to do all the dive, you know, and that's what happened then. And I think that people realized that also we Germans, we can take the humor, we can take a little bit of stick, we can make fun of ourselves as well. I was then explained, obviously, that it had a little bit to do with the 90 semifinal in Italy, where some thought, you know, I did some dives, which I didn't. I tried to explain it, but that doesn't matter. You know, that's not important. It's important was that that I took it the right way. And I knew that if I score goals, if I give everything I have, if I prove my point of being a good football player, the people will accept me. And that's how it went. And I felt like in London, and especially, you know, in the Tottenham and Northwest, I felt like being at home. I felt like I'd be a part of the family in a certain way. And still today, if I go back and see my old teammates and go to a game, I feel like I never left.
So nice. And obviously, this is an audio podcast. People can't see this, but we're talking to each other on Zoom. You're in the US, I'm in the UK. And behind you, you've got the White Hart Lane N17 street sign. You've got a Tottenham flag and your Player of the Month award, of which you picked up a few while you were over here. I'm really intrigued, actually, that it was Teddy Sheringham that came up with the idea for the dive celebration. Because obviously, he's a striker already at Tottenham. You come in as a striker. He could easily have been, hold on, I'm going to make life as difficult as possible for this new arrival. But it seems like there was a great team spirit, right?
Yeah, I mean, it clicked right away with all of my teammates, really. I think they wanted just to see, you know, how I integrate myself, you know, what type of a person I am. And I think they realized after a couple of training sessions that I'm a normal human being like anybody else. And I fit in there. And if they want to have fish and chips, we have fish and chips. If they want to have a beer, we have a beer. And so I had no problem at all to adjust to the new environment. And my teammates made it so easy for me. And Teddy was one of them. Obviously, Gary Mabbott was our skipper, was our kind of leader. He became my roommate then over those years. And I was just getting so exciting because there was so much talent there. There was so much talent in that team. You know, Nicky Bambi, Darren Anderton, Colin Calderwood became then Scottish international, Ian Walker in goal. Fairly young players that just they only could get better. And I went through a similar experience actually at AS Monaco under Arsene Wenger. I came to Monaco almost a bit of an older player, and he gave me the task to guide the younger players. And those younger players in those days in Monaco were Emmanuel Petit, Yuri Djorkaeff, Lilian Thuram, and they were just barely 21, 22. And Arsene Wenger told me, you got to lead these guys. You got to make them understand what it means to get all the way to the top. And a similar role then happened at Spurs too. And I just had a blast.
Amazing. And of course, you know, the Tottenham fans took to you straight away as well. And I think that, you know, they had no issue over your nationality or your history or where you'd played or the competitions you'd won or anything. All they wanted was some amazing flair. And you came into that first game, I remember it, 4-3, late winner. I think that maybe your relationship with the Tottenham fans was maybe sealed from that game. And also maybe your relationship with English football in that moment. You understood what we were about. We understood what you were about.
Yeah, and that's going back to what we discussed before. I think we were actually very similar in many ways. You know, we want attractive attacking football. We want excitement. We want the players to give everything they have on the pitch. And that's what I simply did. And I think, you know, obviously it helps when you score right away in the first game and the second game. But I think most importantly, it is that they want to see you give your heart there on the pitch and be a normal person off the pitch. And that was me. So that's why I just felt so comfortable from day one in England. I just thought this is like I grew up there. It's no difference to my German background.
And you know, when you speak to English football fans now, and you talk about Jürgen Klinsmann, they talk about the dive celebration. They talk about the goals that you scored. What do you think is the other thing they always mention?
Not taking yourself too seriously, you know. I think that's important. I think, you know, it's a team sport. It's about the club. It's about the team. It's about your environment. It's not about you, you know. And I think that's what the people then understood. And I was always curious about the fans, about the people, about my teammates, about, you know, what's going on in the club. You know, also the people that work for the club. And it's you're just part of that special community. And I think that is something that helps me no matter where I go in the world. You know, I was very, very lucky with my career playing in Italy, playing in France, then playing in England, going back again to Germany and ending up in Italy again at the end. Yeah. So all those different chapters during my playing days, you know, made me become a different person, Jake, but I would say you become a person that you just learn to take the people the way they are. You know, no matter where. I mean, now I live since more than 20 years in California, and it's very diverse. You know, you have, you know, Hispanic people, you have Asian people, you have, you know, all colors of people, and you just blend in. You just be one of them, and you take them the way they are. And if they are different, they're different, you know, and you choose, obviously you choose your friends and you choose your environment, but that's what really football taught me.
And you're totally right about this thing about not taking yourself too seriously, because, you know, you coming over, and this was a period where we were starting to get excited actually about the sort of celebrity aspect of football. And you could have been driving a Ferrari or a Lamborghini or something, but you chose a VW Beetle, which I think told us a lot about you and your personality as well. Do you remember that all the reaction that car got? Were you surprised by that?
No, I mean, it was the easiest way to get around London, to be honest, because you cannot go fast anyway. So, I mean, I had in my career, I had a Porsche 911 as well, the nice sports cars. But the Beetle was always with me because it's just going from A to B. And this is how I always looked at things. I need a car to get from A to B. And if it's a sports car, great, you know, but if it's a Beetle, no problem at all. And London was for me a little bit problematic because I had to learn to drive on the left side, obviously. And I just kind of stick to myself and just told myself always when I drove out to the training ground, just follow the cars in front of you. Then you're on the right side of the road. You know, and it happened to me sometimes when I got back from the national team, Germany, let's say 10 days national team break, and I started to drive then to the Spurs training ground, that I caught myself on the right side of the road. Because obviously my steering wheel was on the other side too. So, but then obviously the people honk at you right away and then, boom, I shifted over.
So you're having to deal with the change of culture, obviously off the pitch and driving on the right side of the road and all those things. I'm also interested in what you found of the English football culture generally, you know, the diet that players were enjoying. There was a drinking culture in English football in the 80s and the 90s, all of these different things. What did you make of that?
Well, I was lucky. I had two experiences before that. I was in Italy for 3 years, you know, where the diet and the way they drink is very, very different. Obviously, Mediterranean, Italian, for them, the food is everything. And so, and then I had Arsene Wenger for 2 years at Monaco. And I tell you that in the early 90s, he had already a nutritionist with the team. So we were getting best food, and you can imagine the food was prepared for away games on the way back. You know, we flew everything with a double engine plane with Monaco, and on the plane then there was no alcohol, there was no nothing, there was just prepared food, athletic kind of driven, and I always begged him for, man, Arsene, come on, I'm one of the older guys, can I just have a beer or a glass of wine? And sometimes he made an exception for me, but no, I mean, I think, you know, at those days, actually, it was, again, going back then to the similarities with Germany, we were very similar. We exaggerated the drink maybe after games or sometimes during the week or when we go out in a pub or we go out to a club. And I experienced that, obviously, in England, too. But I think then in those 90s, then step by step, you know, kind of international coaches came into the Premier League. And they, step by step, it's not happening overnight, obviously, but step by step, they change the awareness of certain things. You know, they brought in the idea maybe to go into a training camp, to go into a hotel the night before a home game, which I really hated. Jake, I love the English way. You drive directly to the stadium, you get the job done, you know. For me, that was the maximum because I could sleep at home, I could have my breakfast at home, and then step by step, I roll towards White Hart Lane. And for me, it was exciting because you feel then the people walking to the stadium, going to the stadium, and you just drive through the crowd then at the end, an hour and a half before the game, and it gives you an enormous amount of energy. But obviously, with all the international managers coming into the Premier League, then it changed step by step. And it's now, it's a science. It's a science, you know. Managers, they have staffs around the team of so many different departments, the nutritional department, the scouting department, the data department, the fitness department. You know, you run probably 50, 60, 70 people outside of the 25 players that you actually have to look after. So the workload for a manager today is a completely different one. And one of the main characteristics a manager has to have today is communication skills, first and foremost, but also organizational skills to empower people to do actually their job. You know, to whatever, if it's your assistant coaches, to give them specific tasks, or if it's all the logistics on the side of things, and you become more of a business manager at the end of the day than actually a football manager like it was in the early 90s.
So what was your, let's talk then about Ozzie Ardiles, who was your first manager in the Premier League. I mean, he was, you know, famed for brilliant attacking football. I'm sure it was a dream for you as a striker to play in that team, wasn't it? And this was in the days when it was the manager's job was different.
I mean, he had the idea to really play so attacking that we were a little bit messed up in the backs. and we always conceded more goals than we scored. You know, we tried to catch up in front, but in the back, you know. But it was not so bad. He was, we did a lot of individual mistakes. I think, you know, throughout the year, we would have fixed them step by step. You know, I think Ozzie would have been fine staying on board, but then Alan Sugar made the decision to let him go and bring in Jerry Francis. And to be honest, Jerry didn't do much different to Ozzie in a way. Also great personality, wonderful person. But what he did, he stabilized the back line. He just said, you know, this is my back four now. No matter how the next couple of games go, they stay the same back four. And that, over a couple of weeks, gave it a bit more stability. We started to get results. We started to make the points that we needed. So step by step, we came out of the bottom part of the table. And we finished in seventh spot, I think, almost getting into Europe. And we finished in the semifinal of the FA Cup, which Alan Sugar made it possible to get into the FA Cup. So I wished, you know, that Ozzie, you know, could have gone through all that stuff. But you know that once the results are not there, then they blame the manager for it. Both for my time, Jerry Francis and Ozzie were fantastic managers and fantastic human beings.
And there was that real lure of English football at the point that you came across, and the wages were increasing, and, you know, there was a lot of focus in this country on the Premier League. Were other players that you'd played with previously abroad then talking to you about, what's it like? Should I come over? I'm interested. Were you kind of an advocate of English football at this point?
I didn't directly talk to some people and selling them the picture of the Premier League, but obviously it was noticed. The atmosphere in the stadiums, you know, the excitement that is there. And step by step, other players that I knew already those days, some were friends, like Wood Gullit was a friend of mine during the AC and Inter Milan days, you know. Then Gianluca Vialli came to Chelsea. And so step by step, more and more players came to England, and also more and more managers then. And obviously for the top talent in the world, one point is certainly important. It's the financial side of things. No, I mean, suddenly the Premier League was able to compete with the Serie A, and especially also with the big shots in Spain. That word got out there, and more people then looked at England as a very, very serious option.
I think maybe it was you coming over, but not just you coming over to English football, but coming over to English football and changing perceptions about foreign players. I mean, I remember there was a Guardian journalist, I don't know whether you remember this, but he wrote a piece called Why I Hate Jurgen Klinsmann. 2 months later, he revised it to Why I Love Jurgen Klinsmann. And then, of course, you won the Football Writers Footballer of the Year Award, and we can talk about what that meant to you in a moment. But I just think that, you know, maybe the fact that Hullet and Bergkamp and Zola and Vialli and all these other players then came after you'd not just arrived, but arrived and been welcomed and been loved. I wonder whether you feel like you were perhaps one of the pioneers of changing this culture of English football to being so accepting and embracing of foreign talent.
I mean, Jake, certainly I didn't realize that in those days. You know, I was just going with the flow and trying to do my best. Looking back then, after you stopped your career and you saw then, okay, how many players came then a year, 2 years, 3 years after you, it makes you happy. It makes you smile. I mean, I got a lot of compliments throughout my time in England from teachers that the German language is now more requested in the school system. You know, they would like to see, you know, how difficult it is to learn that language. Also from a social point of view, I think really that people looked at each other in a far more relaxed way. I mean, there's no doubt, Jake, that, you know, there was a horrible First and Second World War, you know, and that creates an image of a nation. It creates an image of the people of that nation. And our image was unfortunately not very good, you know, and Germany suffered for that for decades, you know. And I think the first time that really, talking to my father, you know, it was football that made them smile again. The first time was in 54 when they surprisingly beat Hungary in the World Cup 1954 in Switzerland. And they called it then, oh, we can walk tall again in Germany. So it meant the world to Germany that, you know, they can compete in football. So that's why I think we are also so passionate about it, like the English population too. But throughout the decades, then football always became like a way of showing your identity, a way of showing your characteristics, a way of showing your, for your face, you know, and then you measure yourself in competition, and you have famous games in the 70s, you know, with Liverpool, Man United, and Bayern Munich, Borussia Mönchengladbach those days, and so on until today, you know, when England clashes with Germany in whatever competition, it's like a bank holiday and Christmas all together.
Correct.
And so the social dynamic of this game is just so huge. And me as a player, I didn't realize that. You know, I was just going along and trying to play as good as I could and fit into the environment. Later on, you just start to realize actually what it means and what capabilities football has to bring people together. You know, and maybe even arguing, maybe having different opinions, maybe getting into a little bit of a too much of that. But, you know, it's still about the game. And that's what I experienced in those years.
And taking into account the fact that you were aware that you're a German player coming into English football, tell me what it meant then for you to win the Football Writers Footballer of the Year Award. It feels like the ultimate turnaround from that bad press and your own personal concerns at the beginning to win that award. What did it mean to you?
Oh, it meant the world to me, to be honest, Jake, because the way I started and I didn't win the Premier League. I didn't win the Champions League with Spurs that year. You know, we finished seventh. You know, it's not that, you know, you could say, okay, I got the club two trophies here and it's party time. No, it meant the world to me because it was so much recognition from smart people that say, you know what, he went through a lot, you know, but he had the qualities and he had the guts to respond the right way and also to become one of us, you know, I obviously was aware of the history with Bert Trautmann after World War II. You know, in his days with Man City, what he's done was just unbelievable. That's a real story. But I was extremely proud for that recognition.
Love that. So how do you look back then now, all these years later, on that first period you had at Tottenham Hotspur?
I mean, now I'm looking at things obviously more from a manager perspective because I was lucky enough then to kind of after the playing career to step by step going into management and having my experience in management. And you look at things now, how it changed the environment, how it improved, you know, how whatever professional training grounds the clubs have, the stadiums are fantastic. But you also see the relationship between the business side of things and the football side of things, you know, and the complication that arises with all those things, you know, who makes the decision, you know, is it football people or is it business people, is it money people and so forth. So it's not easy today, not for the people that run the clubs, and it's not easy for players either. So, you know, obviously since 1990 with the internet and slowly now and over the last years then coming social media, I don't want to be in the shoes of the players, you know, because I can go into a pub and have a beer and I can go in supermarket and buy my groceries and and I'm not followed by cell phones, you know, and taking pictures of me. So even if obviously I'm getting dizzy when I read about the amount of money they make, and they say, shoot, you know, should I have played 30 years later? But to be honest, I would not want to change with the players of today. And my son is a professional player as well, because they have to kind of deal with a lot of stuff that we didn't have to deal with.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Let's focus on someone else who played a big part in your life and in your career, and indeed in English football, Arsene Wenger. He's still looked on, I think, as having helped to revolutionise the game in this country on and off the pitch. No one had even heard of Arsene Wenger, Jürgen, when he came to English football in the 90s. But of course, you worked with him in Monaco. So when you heard that this unknown to us had joined one of the biggest clubs in England, did you instinctively know that he would have a big impact on the English game, or did it surprise you just how amazingly he did?
No, it didn't surprise me at all how amazingly he did. He simply just chose the wrong club, you know. No, jokes aside. No, I mean, I met Arsene Wenger and I worked those 2 years with him. We reached the semifinals in the Champions League. In my second year with AS Monaco, we lost in the semifinal at AC Milan against a great team then. But he was so knowledgeable already at those days that I knew that no matter what teams he will take over in the future time, if he stays in France, or obviously he went then for 2 years to Japan, and then from Japan, then he came over to the Premier League. I saw in him an extremely intelligent person, a person that always foresees certain things, how they develop, always curious, is constantly learning and still learning today. You know, I still have a very good relationship with him today, as he is the technical director of FIFA at the moment. Mm. So I was not surprised at all. I mean, we often met up and we talked about his time at Arsenal and what he had to deal with once they wanted to build the stadium. You know, they had to reduce his the payroll, basically. So we knew that it's going to be difficult to win the championship again, because he doesn't have the same resources as the other big clubs have. But he is just a simple, he's just a gentleman, very intellectual, very knowledgeable, very intelligent, and very passionate as well.
And have you ever spoken to him about how he found the change in culture coming over to English football?
Yeah, we did here and there. Yeah. And I think he was extremely smart, because he was already ahead of his time. And for people that are ahead of their time, it's very difficult to kind of slow down the changes they want to do. You know, I mean, I made a couple of mistakes in my managerial kind of time at certain places, maybe at Bayern Munich, where I was a year. I wanted to do too many things right away. You know, I didn't have the patience. And I think if you want to introduce change, if you want to do certain things differently, the timing plays a really crucial role. I think that's where Arsene Wenger did a fantastic job at Arsenal, and where especially Jurgen Klopp is doing an outstanding job since 6 years at Liverpool, 6-7 years, because he's also full of ideas. He's always thinking about, you know, what's next? You know, what can we do for the players, for the club, for it? And you have to slow yourself down, and you have to adjust to the tempo of your people, of that specific environment. And that's what both do really, really well. You know, they might have other things kind of already in the back of their minds, but they wait with it because they say, you know, first of all, now we do this. So they prioritize the things the right way. And Arsene Wenger always prioritize things correctly.
It's a good point you make there, actually. And when you look back on, you know, foreign visitors coming in and having an impact in English football, whether it is Jurgen Klopp now at Liverpool, Arsene at Arsenal, you at Tottenham, it's the people that make the effort to understand the fans and the club. They're the ones that have the impact, aren't they? The ones that can emotionally connect, not just on a football level, but get to people's hearts, not just their heads.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Jake. I mean, you as a manager, when you go into a new place, you have to figure out how the people think there, how the club works. So you have to kind of put a lot of time and effort into evaluate and and into meeting the people, and then pick up their rhythm, pick up their way of doing things, and then go from there. You know, then when you once have, you know, have it figured out and you know the people good enough, then maybe it's time now to make this or that change, but not before that. The only problem with that is, Jake, that the managers are not giving often the time. There are a lot of, I mean, take, I would say maybe as an example, we can take David Moyes. For me, David Moyes was absolutely the right choice for Man United. Absolutely right. But you got to give him 2-3 years. Or Andrea Pirlo was just recently at Juventus 3 years ago. They asked him for change the club, kind of introduce a more attacking style of football, more entertaining style of football. And he had it all sorted out. He wrote even, you know, his final assignment of his coaching license for about that. And boom, he won even 2 cups in that first year, but it was not enough for Juventus, and they fired him after year one by introducing all those changes right away instead of just take your time to do that. And so this is very, that's the other side of the problem is, you know, can you really get the time and then, you know, make your changes that you want to make?
And of course, you then made an emotional return to Tottenham, didn't you, in the 97-98 season. Can you explain how that move came about?
Oh, that was very simple. I was at Sampdoria Genoa my final year there and had Cesar Luis Menotti as my coach. And he was the reason why I went there because I loved him, you know, Argentina. It was like Ozzy Artil, a similar kind of situation. But then he, after 3 months, I broke a ligament. I was out for 6 weeks, tore a ligament. And then I got back into shape. And one morning I come to the training ground and ask, where's the manager? Where's Cesar Luis Menotti? So on the grounds, man, tell Jürgen, he's not here anymore. He left last night to Buenos Aires with the entire coaching staff. They resigned. And I said, what? Are you crazy? And then they made a change of coach, a former Yugoslavian coach that I knew this is not going to go well. I mean, there are certain personalities where I know we don't match, you know, and when we don't match, then it's better not to go into kind of a daily confrontation. So after 5-6 months, then right before Christmas, I asked the club owner if he would release me, if I would get him a team and pays a little bit of a transfer fee. I mean, I was, I don't know, 33 already, 32, 33. And he was fantastic, the president there at Genoa. And Christian Gross, the Swiss coach, was the manager at Spurs. We had a phone call and we said, let's do that. Spurs was in trouble. They were second of the bottom. I was in trouble because I want to go into the World Cup 98 in France on top of my game. And so it worked well. And we helped each other out. But in those months then, by doing that, I realized that I'm probably good now with my career. Our son was born 8 months prior to that in Munich, still when I played for Bayern Munich. And I just felt like it's time for the family.
It's nice. And actually, there's a nice bit of poetry about that return to Tottenham, because not only did you score, you know, some vital goals that saved them from relegation. I'm thinking of those 4 goals you scored when you beat Wimbledon 6-2, crucial day that day. But also that was the final real appearances at the top level for a club that you made. And I think there's something nice about that, because you had such an impact at Tottenham and such an impact on English football. It feels right almost that you signed off there, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I felt like, and I was not on top of my game anymore. I think that I probably peaked. Really, I peaked in 94, 95, 96. That's when I really kind of had my peak. So in a certain way, I knew that I will not be the standout or player or the level I was, you know, 2 or 3 years prior to that. And I wanted to go out on a high note, not kind of on a too low kind of situation. I didn't want to drag it out and just kind of lie to myself that I'm not as fast anymore as I was before, or whatever qualities you have. So it from a timing point of view, in this case, it really worked out well.
So how different was the Premier League that you returned to from the one that you'd originally joined 4 years before?
It was a little bit different. Obviously, more foreign players were in the league, you know, so it got more and more an international picture. Meanwhile, when I came in first place, that was 95% English. But it started just to become a lot more, mixed. You know, there was elements from managers. They more and more put their stamp on their clubs, and obviously with the amount of foreign players now being allowed to come into the UK, that was a bit different. So it changed a little bit, but to the better, because all those people that came in those days, they really appreciated it to play in the Premier League or to manage in the Premier League.
And have you got close to coming back to the Premier League at any point? I mean, you've had an interesting management career so far. Have you ever had conversations with any other Premier League clubs?
Yes, I did. I did have a conversation years ago after I coached Germany in 2006 at the World Cup. And then in 2008, I had offers from the Premier League, big teams, but I decided to join Bayern Munich because when in Germany, it's when Franz Beckenbauer calls you, you cannot say no.
Yes.
So maybe I should have made a different decision there, but I don't regret it at all. I had fantastic experiences so far in management. And now, obviously, being at the end of the COVID ride, you know, I hope that maybe after the World Cup, I get some opportunities to jump back in.
So the story isn't over just yet. I'm interested to know whether you have a desire to manage in English football in the Premier League.
Oh, I think it's a fascinating thought for any manager out there to coach and to manage in England, because of not only because of the resources, you know, and what they built over the last 30 years. Also, it's for me, it's because the passion of the people, how they kind of really suffer with their teams, how they party with their teams. The level of identity that the fans have in England with their clubs, you know, whatever club it is, doesn't matter if it's in the Premier League or if it's in a lower division team. It's wonderful to see.
Amazing. And what do you make of the Premier League now, all these years on? You now watch from afar in the States. What do you think of the amazing talent that's come from overseas and has helped to change our league for the better?
Well, on the business side of things, they've done it extraordinary. I mean, it's you just can give them compliments after compliments. On the football side of things, it's the best league in the world. You know, and I say that as an ambassador of the Bundesliga. I'm one of the international ambassadors for the Bundesliga, and obviously we have to admit that in Germany that the number one league in the world is the Premier League. And then, you know, the Bundesliga, Serie A, La Liga, and obviously with Barcelona, Real Madrid, Atletico, and obviously lately also the French league, they're behind that. So they're kind of one level below. With fantastic clubs, no, don't get me wrong, but what the Premier League is really all about is, you know, anybody can beat anybody on a good day. Even if you think you go down to Southampton and you are Man City, doesn't mean that you're going to go home with the 3 points. You know, you have to do a lot of work to get your 3 points at Southampton or at any other team in the Premier League. And that's what is, it's just fun to watch.
Well, Jürgen, thank you so much for your time. Enjoy the United States, and you'll be welcomed, obviously, with open arms anytime you want to come back and do some work here in English football.
Thank you. Appreciate it. It's fun talking to you.
It's incredible, isn't it, to look at the Premier League we have today and hear how it all started with this foreign influence. A few years later at Tottenham, and a teammate of Klinsmann's, when he briefly returned, David Ginola won the PFA Player of the Year in 1999. Cleaning his boots, a young Peter Crouch.
That was the season he won PFA Player of the Year, and he was unbelievable at Spurs that year. I remember just watching him. We used to go to every game. He was an absolute genius. And I was in charge of his boots. So I was like, you know, honour for me to just hand him his boots every day. I got in a bit of trouble because I was just putting loads of polish all over the Nike sign. And Nike got in touch and weren't too pleased with that. But I felt it was down to me, really, that he won Player of the Year because I was on his boots. But absolute joy to watch. Certainly when I was a kid, it was very raised. You didn't see many foreign players, you know, so you grew up with the culture. It was very English culture, really, British culture. So then when these players came over, like, things changed. And I was in the youth team at Tottenham and just learning and watching exactly what they're doing. And it helps no end. I think, you know, you speak to Ashley Cole, for instance, who came through at Arsenal, watching those, you know, Bergkamp, Henri, Vieira, Wenger, even, you know, like the effect that it had on him and how he changed his methods and stuff. And it was just benefit, so beneficial to all of us, really, to see players like that at the top of their game and how professional they were and how much that probably helped us.
So after this influx of Premier League foreign stars, who is the greatest of all time? A couple are left in no doubt.
Thierry Henry, I think he's by far the best. I think we've had some incredible talent over here. And I think Aguero's goal record, obviously, is right up there, isn't he? Like 180 yards. And he's got more than Henry, isn't he, now? But what Henry's influence on Arsenal, on the Premier League, at a time when, you know, I think it was all quite new. I think Zola was part of that sort of inspirational sort of generation. Bergkamp, Cantona. I think those players, I think certainly those four were the best that I've ever seen. And probably just of personal preference, the four that I enjoyed watching the most, Zola and Bergkamp were absolute geniuses. Like, I absolutely love watching both of them. But just for everything, goals, assists, you know, just pace, skill, power, finishing. He had absolutely everything. I don't think you can beat Thierry Henry.
Michael Owen saw Henry as his first challenge to the Premier League Golden Boot.
I think that's quite an easy answer. Thierry Henry. Very few players in my lifetime I've looked at and thought, uh-oh, I can't. You know, I've always had dreams of being the best player in the world, scoring as many goals, you know, winning the Golden Boots, winning World Cups, winning leagues, or whatever it was. And there's once or twice I've looked at a player and thought, wow, if that's the level, you can give up on your dream of being the best player.
We'll hear much, much more from Michael Owen next time. Chapter 6 is The Boy Wonder.
Sport Pods.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.